of Islam, the knowledge of the Quran, the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet. That is a different topic. It's related, it's very much connected, but I insist on understanding this so that we don't dismiss it as this is for others. No, this is for us. Companions of the Imam would come and ask questions about the Ahkam. The Imam could simply just say, this is what the hukm is. The Imam doesn't do that. He said, have you read this verse of the Quran? Or in some instances, this could be understood from this verse of the Quran, that verse of the Quran. Telling people, go back to the Quran itself. What happened to that? Instead of going and saying, oh, hadith says, من الناس من يشري نفسه ابتغاء مرضات الله. Hadith says this is Ibn Muljam. Like, okay, hadith says it's Ibn Muljam. It must be Ibn Muljam. We're confused here. من يقول من يعجبك قوله في الحياة الدنيا وهو ألد الخصام. This is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Hadith says it's Ali ibn Abi Talib. We get, Imam says, look at the verse of the Quran. Look at the Quran itself. The Quran says, من الناس من يشري نفسه ابتغاء مرضات الله. There are those who give up their souls for مرضات الله. Then go and look at what's available. It's not too difficult to find out who Ibn Muljam is, and too difficult to find out who Ali ibn Abi Talib, his track record. Now you see, is this من الناس من يشري نفسه ابتغاء مرضات الله or that? They can fabricate hadith. The Imams kept repeating, go to the Quran, read the Quran. Look at the Quran. The approach to go to the Quran, get an understanding, judge hadith based on what Quran says. This is one of those lines that is repeatedly mentioned by the Imam. It's not a specific, you know, do this or do that, this hukm or that verse of the Quran, the tafsir of it, this story in the Quran, that story at the time of the Prophet or previous revelations. All those are important. But these are guidelines that straighten out your thinking process. It helps you be able to clear up not one issue, 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000 issues. These are keys to knowledge. Go to the Quran. Read the Quran. This is one of the major teachings of Imam Zain al-Abidin. The second very important thing that the Imam repeats, and we see the effect of it. Again, I will like to present this very briefly. Look, the compilers of hadith that started putting books together, they all fall a little after, they start doing this work a little after roughly the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin. The process starts at that point. There is close to a century before that time. Why did that not happen? Why did that not happen? Because the work of the Ahlul Bayt wasn't on this area. They were trying to, again, when we discussed Imam al-Mujtaba and Imam al-Husayn, what their objective, how they were trying to bring the Ummah back onto its track was different. That didn't work. They started working in this way. Imam Zain al-Abidin onwards started working on this. These teachings of Imam al-Baqir are what led to the Muslim community developing this form of scholarship that you have the likes of Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim and the other Sahih Sitta. They went towards filtering out the hadith based on what principle? Based on what? Check the narrators of hadith. Who's narrating this hadith? What's the chain of transmission? This is the work of Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhi that has led to this. Somebody tells you Amir al-Mu'mineen said this. Okay. I didn't live Amir al-Mu'mineen. Anything he says is on my head. I will kiss it and I will accept it no matter what it is. If he has said it. But has he said it or not? Someone claiming Ali ibn Abi Talib said it doesn't mean that he said it. Someone claiming the Prophet said it doesn't mean he said it. Someone claiming Imam al-Husayn said something doesn't mean he said it. Based on what? What's the evidence of him saying it? What book was this taken off of? Imam al-Baqir stressed on this. And it affected the entirety of the Muslim community. Those books started coming out. The works of the companions of the Ahlul Bayt became even more strict. They were even more careful. And that's why we say the majority of the ahadith that we have compiled in our books, compilations of hadith, is much more accurate. Still, does that mean there is nothing that is off? If it's in our books, that means it's accepted? No, again, that's... There is no saying from any of the imams suggesting this book or that book, whatever is in it is accepted. We have said, if this book says it, we have said it. There's no such thing whatsoever. The imams stressed on this for that time onwards. So all the way until the end of the minor occultation, when Kulayni puts his book together, he is relying on a volume of resources, books of various scholars. Does he just take that book and narrate whatever's in it? Absolutely not. But this is the book of Hariz ibn Abdullah al-Sajistani, the student of Zurara ibn Ayan. Doesn't matter, that's what the book says, but there's this copy, there's the other copy, this one comes from this person, that comes from that person. The reason why the hadith book of Al-Kafi took 20 years to compile is not because the resources weren't there. It's because Kulayni is very careful. Where did this come from? Where did that come from? Now, if Kulayni did that, does that mean whatever he says? No, that doesn't mean if his judgment is that it's the saying of the imam. Although this filters out a lot of stuff, it still doesn't mean it's necessary. There's still the process of ijtihad in looking at this. This is the teaching of Imam al-Baqir.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's tip, dear friends, what are the secrets of enhancing our ubudiyya, enhancing our servitude of Allah, in the words of the esteemed Imam Khomeini? So, dear listeners, in the past few sessions, we've been talking about the secrets of enhancing our ubudiyya, enhancing our servitude and our worship of Allah. Interestingly, we are discussing this concept of enhancing ubudiyya in the words of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution. So, dear listeners, we find that Imam Khomeini, he writes that the great prophets and the close friends of Allah, the awliya Allah, despite their daily works like other people, they were never on good terms with the world, the dunya, because they worked with Allah and they worked for Allah. Dear friends, what a beautiful and profound statement, which is directly related to ubudiyya, to the servitude of Allah and to the worship of Allah. Imam Khomeini says that the great prophets of Allah, and matter of fact, all the prophets of Allah and those people who are close to Allah, they have a high level and a high rank when it is in the eyes of Allah, as we say, awliya Allah in Arabic. These people did daily works. They worked for a living in one way or the other. We find that despite them working like other people worked for their daily sustenance, they were never on good terms with the materialistic world. For example, we find one of the awliya of Allah, the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, the best and most perfect living miracle of the Holy Prophet of Allah, along with, of course, his daughter, Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace and blessings upon her. We find that Imam Ali, he said that, O world, materialistic world, I divorce you three times from a divorce which no one can return. This is how, dear friends, the awliya of Allah, the prophets of Allah, the imams of Allah, the chosen people of Allah, this is how they were. They weren't attached to the materialistic wealth and the materialistic glamour of this world. And this in itself is a secret of ubudiyya. It is a secret of the servitude of Allah. Of course, either one can be of service to, be in servitude of, and worship either the world, the dunya, the materialistic wealth, materialistic power and wealth and money and greed, or one can be of service to, one can be of servitude to and one can worship Allah, the master and the creator of all of existence. And very quickly, the last thing that Imam Khomeini says here as regards to our discussion of Ubudiyya is that these people, the prophets of Allah, the chosen people of Allah, the close friends of Allah, the special people of Allah, those whom Allah loves and they love Allah, these people, they worked for Allah. They worked with Allah. They worked for the cause of Allah. They helped the cause of Allah. These, dear friends, are the secrets of Ubudiyya.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'd like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatu Ta'ibin, the whispered prayer of the repenters. Please stay with me. My God, let the cloud of your mercy cast its shadow upon my sins, and send the billow of your clemency flowing over my faults. My God, does the fugitive servant return to anyone other than his master? Or does anyone grant him sanctuary from his master's wrath other than his master himself? My God, if remorse for sins is a repentance, I, by your might, am one of the remorseful. If praying forgiveness for offenses is an alleviation, I am one of those who pray forgiveness. To you I return, that you may be well pleased. My God, through your power over me, turn toward me. Through your clemency toward me, pardon me, and for your knowledge of me, be gentle toward me.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Now, in continuation to what we were talking about, which of course was Ubudiyya in the words of Imam Khomeini, we just talked about how the great prophets and the close friends of Allah, that despite their daily work in order to acquire their sustenance and their rizq, we found that they were never on good terms with the materialistic world. Of course, as we said, because when you are in servitude of the materialistic world, then how can you be in servitude of Allah? Imam Khomeini continues and he writes, if you settle your accounts with Allah and take refuge in remembering Allah, you need not fear any creature, as the reckoning and the judgment of creatures is transitory, it is temporary, while the reckoning before Allah is eternal. And so, dear friends, here, when we talk about Ubudiyya, when we talk about our servitude and our worship of Allah, what a beautiful key here given to us by Imam Khomeini, that we spend so much of our life trying to settle the accounts, or settle our accounts, our good and bad deeds, our nice things that we have said, our bad things we have said, our hurting other people's feelings, right? We settle our accounts with people. And interestingly, we live in a day and age where we even settle our accounts with animals. It is amazing and it is unfortunate at the same time that in some cases we are willing to settle our accounts with animals, but we aren't willing to settle our accounts with people, and let alone we totally forget about our account with Allah. And so here Imam Khomeini reminds us that in the servitude of Allah, in the worship of Allah, in trying to enhance and increase our ubudiyyah, we need to first and foremost settle our accounts with Allah, tell Allah what we have done good, and thank Him for gracing us and allowing us to do good, and likewise settle our accounts with Allah, tell Allah the bad things that we have done, the disobedience we have committed, and ask Allah for forgiveness, and all the while take refuge, seek protection, seek safety in remembering Allah. And of course, finally, Imam Khomeini says, don't fear any creature, and don't fear the reckoning of any creature, for the reckoning of creatures is transitory, but the reckoning before Allah is eternal. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
There are many beautiful, beautiful promises of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the mu'mineen and mu'minat. In order to be considered mu'min and a believer according to the Quran, we have to have intellectual conviction that Islam is the truth. It's not a religion that I'm following because of my forefathers or anybody else. I personally am convinced this is Islam, this is the truth. In order to be considered mu'min is that, different than other faiths, it's not going to be a religion where my iman or my faith is only in my heart. The Quran specifies and teaches us that if you are mu'min in Islam, that iman is going to demonstrate itself in our actions. Islam is not a buffet, it's a package deal. Someone who is a Muslim has intellectual conviction that the Quran is the book of God, that Imam Ali is really the first Imam. This person has to embrace all of Islam. Picking and choosing in Islam does not lead one to be considered mu'min, and the promises of God are not for those who are not mu'mineen. So, back to the topic. The topic is that God, the creator of the universe, has confidence in you and I. Some of us might not think of ourselves as a champion, as someone who's a game changer, but what's important is how God views us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And by the way, sisters, this promise that I'm going to share you the verse of Quran with you, this promise that we're going to be sharing and inshallah pondering on and then taking benefit from, is a promise which means no matter what the challenge in life I've been given, Allah has confidence in. It might be dealing with family. Sometimes people have marital issues. Sometimes their children are not doing what they would like. Sometimes their spouse, sometimes relatives. That might be one challenge. It might be a personal challenge. Sometimes someone is a mu'min or mu'mina, maybe not in this community, but it happens. Somebody's even dealing with something as like addiction, be a personal struggle that the person is going through. Sometimes it might be financial issues. You'd be surprised, inshallah, all of you are doing very well financially. Sometimes for mu'mineen and mu'minat, the struggles they're going through, they can't even explain to you and I. Sometimes people are going through financial issues. Sometimes it's a lawsuit. They look on the other side of the equation, on the other side of the table. The enemy seems so powerful. Those who are after them are so strong. But again, Allah believes in me. I can do it. I'm up to the task. It might be long-term health issues.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kaluts.
I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kaluts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Megadunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Megadunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer, with no trace of life among them. The Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kaluts or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kaluts area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kaluts, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kaluts are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalud formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different kalutz or yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutz in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutz in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutz. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutz for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutz, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable.
Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses, that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. The dazzling beauties of the Kaluts redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeved shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of glasses, sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kaluts area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluts expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluts themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. The They are all very brittle. The shape of each kalud depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the kalud's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the kaluds with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word kalud. Kalud is a blend of two words, kal and lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as kalate and kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word kalat means a walled-off village. The kaluds are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the kaluds of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark. When on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone kalud surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Siege Mountains back there towards the kaluds. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This kalud hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the kaluds, the winds are so strong, they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the kaluds area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the kaluds, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the kaluds area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to, and when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot.
I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday, I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. You are listening to The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode and sharing your time, your valuable, precious time. I'm sure you guys are busy doing very important things. But the good thing about radio shows and audios is that you get to do whatever it is that you're doing and, you know, listen to something that I hope is useful for all of us and acts as a reminder, as the name entails, a little lantern to help us during times of negligence and forgetfulness and maybe streaks of darkness we might have in our lives. So thank you for joining us, basically. We also have a Telegram channel, Call of Islam Radio, and a page on Instagram where you can share with us your thoughts and comments and suggestions, any questions you might have, any topics you wish for us to discuss, and say it to us in our face if you find anything unfavorable and uninteresting about our show, rather than perhaps, I don't know, sitting around and telling each other, oh my god, the show is so boring. Where did they even find this host? Why can't they talk about more interesting stuff? We're still not listening to it anymore. Because, number one, it's unproductive. You can help us improve by telling us any issues and flaws and faults you find in our show directly. And also, it is not within Islamic ethics. I'm telling this to myself first and foremost as a reminder that Zainab, it is not Islam, it's not ethical for a Muslim to say unfavorable things behind a fellow brother or sister's back that they would not say to their face. Not only that, it is not ethical, Islamically speaking, to be in a gathering where someone we know is being spoken ill of behind their back and for us not to defend them. What do I mean by this? Let's listen to an actual anecdote, an actual story, so maybe that would probably help us wrap our minds around this concept better, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends of this program, Lantern, so welcome. We have an interesting story for today, so let's see what's the title. Being loyal to those not present. Being loyal to those not present is one of the most difficult of all the deposits. It is one of the highest tests of both character and the depth of bonding that has taken place in a relationship. This is particularly the case when everyone seems to be joining in on bad-mouthing and piling on someone who is not present. You can just speak up and say, "I see it differently," or "My experience is different," or "You may have a point, let's go talk to him or her about it." By doing so, you instantly communicate that integrity is loyalty, not just to those absent, but also to those who are present. All the people present will inwardly admire and respect you. I remember heading up a meeting in a large organization where the formal leaders were discussing various personnel issues. They seemed to be in complete agreement regarding the weakness of a particular individual. They even began to tell jokes and funny stories about this individual in ways they would never do to the person's face. Later, the same day, one of the executives came to me and said that for the first time he could now trust my expressions of appreciation and affection for him. "Why so?" I asked. He replied, "Because when we were cutting that person in our earlier meeting, you went against the current and showed genuine concern, care, and regard for them." I asked why that had impacted him. He said, "Because I have similar weakness, only they're worse. No one knows about them, not even you. So every time you've expressed your appreciation and regard for me inwardly, I've said, 'But you don't understand. Today I feel you would. I feel you would be true and loyal to me even in my absence, and that I can trust you and believe your kind expressions.'" Yes, the key to the many is often the one. It is how you regard and talk about the one in the one's absence and presence that communicates to the many how you would regard and talk about them in their presence or absence. Thank you for joining us. Now we'll listen to the continuation of this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. Author of this story was Stefan R. Covey.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So basically, the point I'm trying to make is that in Islam, we're taught that if someone, that a Muslim is his fellow Muslim brother's mirror, right? The mu'mineen, the believers, are mirrors for one another because they remind each other not only of their virtues and merits, like when you go stand in front of the mirror and you see, wow, my eyebrows are on fleek, my skin is glowing, my hair is popping, my hijab is looking good, I'm so fit, I look so healthy. Oh, but ooh, what do we have here? I have a stain on my scarf, on my abaya. There's a drop of chocolate on my lips. You know what I'm trying to say? Basically, we have to remind each other that, hey, look, that fault that you had in private, in courteous, considerate, soft words, that, hey, maybe you shouldn't have done that. Hey, do you think it's a better idea if we could discuss so-and-so attitude of yours? You know, I'd say that to a close friend of mine with love, compassion, and understanding. And also, if I'm in a gathering and someone whom I know is being spoken of in an ill manner, it's upon me to defend them. It's upon me to defend their integrity, their honor, their reputation. There's a hadith from one of